Welcome to Face the Jury, the podcast dedicated to confronting the issues of medical malpractice in America, what it is, how to spot it, and how to protect you and your family from medical negligence. I'm your host, Lloyd Bell, a medical malpractice trial lawyer representing people who've been harmed by medical negligence. For more information, visit us at belllawfirm.com. This episode of Face the Jury is brought to you by our friends at Hughes Bee Reporting, the nationwide leader in court reporting, videography, and trial services. Visit HughesBee.com for more information. That's HUSEBY.com. Today we have a special guest that may come as a surprise to many of our listeners and a shock to some. Our guest is widely considered to be the most successful medical malpractice defense lawyer in the state of Georgia. At one point in his career, our guest had a winning streak of 50 defense verdicts in a row. Our guest grew up in rural West Georgia along the Georgia-Alabama border in the frontier town of Carrollton. He played football at Central Carrollton High School and excelled on his high school debate team. He consistently defeated the debate teams at all the fancy high-end private schools in Atlanta and led his debate team to numerous statewide and national championships. He graduated from West Georgia and went on to the University of Georgia Law School. And from the beginning of his career, our guest has defended doctors and nurses accused of medical malpractice. He started his own defense firm back in 2005 with his wife, Molly, who was also his law partner and a highly accomplished lawyer in her own right. He is a member of the prestigious American Academy of Trial Lawyers and just recently received the Lifetime Achievement Award, the highest recognition given by the Chief Justice's Commission on Professionalism for his pro bono work in the community. And lastly, and most importantly, our guest is the father of seven, yes, seven children, including one son who practices law with him, another son who is a lacrosse player at Princeton, and a cheerleading daughter at the University of Georgia, all high achievers like their father. I've tried many cases against this defense lawyer, sometimes coming out on top, sometimes coming in second. And I can tell you, he is the ultimate professional, a skilled courtroom opponent, a highly ethical lawyer who always fights hard for his clients. When a doctor or nurse gets sued in Georgia, our guest is almost always their defense lawyer of choice. So it is my pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Paul Wethington. Paul, welcome to Face the Jury.
Lloyd, thanks for having me. And you read my bio that I wrote very nicely there.
Yeah, how about that introduction? That boy,
was,
I tell you.
That was way too much. I appreciate it coming from you, a most worthy adversary in these cases. I appreciate all those nice comments.
Well, this is my pleasure, and I'm really happy to have you here on the show. And since I'm sure you are a regular listener to my podcast, Face the Jury, you know that this podcast is focused primarily on the issues of medical malpractice from the patient's point of view. So you are my first guest to bring the doctor's point of view, the nurse's point of view, being on the other side of medical malpractice cases. So I want you to tell us, first of all, how you came to focus your professional life on defending medical malpractice cases.
It's not that noteworthy of a story. I had practiced big law here in Atlanta at Troutman Sanders and then with David Flint. Got recruited to go back home to Carrollton to the Tysinger firm out there that had a niche practice in medical malpractice defense in the West Georgia area. David Tysinger developed a bunch of great clients, the Houston Clinic and Tanner Medical Center and groups in that region. And I was lucky enough that he asked me to help him with cases, and I sort of stumbled into it. Tried my first case by myself with Lance Lurie as a co-defense lawyer before he saw the light and matriculated over to the plaintiff's side. But that's kind of how I ambled into it. And then I was lucky enough to be trying a murder case in Carrollton while Hunter Allen was trying a malpractice case the same week. I was in Superior Court. He was in State Court. I gave him the lowdown on Carroll County juries and that kind of thing. And next thing you know, he talked me into coming back to Atlanta and putting silk stockings on again and working, doing a lot of Emory's defense. And I'm very honored to have David Tysinger and Hunter Allen as mentors.
Well, those are all fine lawyers that I've dealt with a number of times. And you and Hunter getting together, sort of like Smith and Wesson getting together and joining forces. He's a fine lawyer too.
Hunter's got one speed, and it's his speed, and you know he's still going strong. You know, in his 70s, like many people on your side of the bar as well. But that's kind of how I got into MedMal, and honestly. You know, I'm not a legal scholar. I was on the law review, and that's about the extent of it. But the law in medical malpractice cases is not as challenging sometimes as the medicine, as you know, in these complex medical issues. And every case is different. Every case is a tragedy on your side and, you know, a blow to the ego on the doctor's side that he's being accused of malpractice. And so the facts of these cases are interesting, and it's, you know, I was never cut out to be a guy that reviewed contracts and that kind of thing, and nor were you. And you know, each case presents its own nuances and challenges, and it's been a good niche to be in.
Well, Paul, let me ask: is it true that you had a winning streak of 50 defense verdicts in a row at one time?
You know, Lloyd, I'm not sure. I didn't promulgate that urban legend. The Daily Report kind of liked that quote. In that 50, there might have been one or two where they gave them $25,000 or something where they'd asked for $5 million. And, you know, so I didn't promote that. It made the newspaper. Of course, I lost a case to break that streak where I had to admit liability. I didn't know how I was supposed to win that one. But, yeah, there's something like that. Your streaks. Of winning on the plaintiff's side.
Well, the point is you've had, and there's no arguing about this, you've had a tremendous amount of success defending these cases over the years. And I want you to tell us what you think makes you successful at trial.
Well.
And don't be falsely modest here. Honest and upfront.
I hope we know the medicine well. I mean, I hope on our side, like on your side, we try to command the medical issues. We use nurses here a lot. We have a JDMD. We try to get the best experts. We try to be on top on the medicine. I think young lawyers and certainly plaintiff's lawyers who are successful will agree, you got to win the jury. And so I've always tried not to do anything to hurt my case with the jury and not to put myself in a position where the jury would not like my client because they didn't like something I did. So I think trying to win the case in voir dire is very important. Getting off on a good footing with the jury and trying to connect with some jurors and, you know, not doing anything out on too many limbs that would alienate any strong members of the jury who might sway the jury against you. So other than just, you know, making, I hope, an organized presentation and dumbing down the medicine for everybody, but knowing the medicine, I just think connecting to the jury from the start to finish, you know, a little levity here and there, not too much so that you are making frivolous or trivial, you know, a heartbreaking injury on the plaintiff's side, but enough occasionally to cut through the tension of a trial, just the right balance of that with hopefully, you know, same wavelength of connection to the jurors. And it's sort of like Russell Crowe in the Gladiator movie, you know, you got to win the crowd, you win your freedom. And so I admire what you've done when these judges have allowed you to use your voir dire technique of going for the first couple of hours and then letting the defense go. I mean, when judges have let you have unfettered access to a jury without the defense speaking for a couple of hours, I've always felt like we're behind winning the jury from the start. And that's why when you do that, it's no offense. I, I object to it because I'd rather be able to talk to the jury a little bit too and not let you have all the mic time.
Of course, but I've got the burden of proof, as we all realize, so I should be having an opportunity to
and you,
have some unfettered access.
You've been persuasive with a few judges on that technique, and but there's no big mystery to it. I mean, I think you want to be organized. I think you don't want to waste the jury's time. I think, you know, you avoid as many fights as you can, and you don't do anything that's going to bring disrespect or, you know, a bad ethos for your client in what in how you conduct yourself. And you never want to lose a case because the jury didn't like you as the lawyer, because your clients can do a good enough job of that, of making the jury mad on both sides.
Yeah, that's definitely the truth. One of the things I've seen you do, Paul, that I think is very effective is when I'm having this unfettered access with the jury, you're not just sitting there passively, you're memorizing all their names. So you have this great capacity to stand up in front of the jury for the first time, and all of a sudden you're talking to them by name without having to refer to the jury roster. So it seems like you have more familiarity with them than, and of course, everybody's favorite word is their own name. People love to hear their name.
There are a couple Lloyd, I was the Rush chairman back in the day, so I had to remember names.
Right.
But I'm, you know, if I get enough time, I can memorize 60 names. And, I do think it's nice when you can stand up and say Ms. Jackson, Ms. Thomas, Ms. Williams, but you guys are freezing me out with these paddles with numbers on them and taking away that little trick. But the only thing you got to worry about, if you mess up one name, that juror is going to hate you forever. So you better know that you've got them all. And so I'm always worried that I'm going to miss one Ms. Williams or Ms. Thomas, and she's going to hate me forever because I didn't really care about her. So now Tony Del Campo, when he was a judge, he would do the same thing. So he may want to rival me on name memorization. But, you know, I do think it just shows, too, you're paying attention, and it shows that, you know, hopefully they think, well, that lawyer's pretty sharp. He knows all our names already. Anyway, it is a little trick.
Well, let me ask you some harder questions, because I talked to a number of my colleagues who were aghast that I was having you on my podcast. They're like, well, it's a plaintiff's podcast. And I said, well, not really. I said, it's a podcast for that focuses on issues of medical malpractice. And I couldn't think of a better guest than to have you on here to talk about your experiences. But everybody had proposed questions I should ask you. My favorite was, I won't mention who told me to pass this along, but my favorite question was, ask him how he shaves in the morning when he can't see his reflection in the mirror, as if you're a vampire demon. I was like, that's not really nice. I'm not going to ask that. So forget I even mentioned it.
I didn't know I alienated anybody that badly.
You've got great respect.
Hey, an electric razor, Lloyd. I mean, okay. You know.
Well, mystery solved. Well, let me ask you some tougher questions and get your candid feedback. What are the three biggest mistakes you consistently see plaintiffs' lawyers make in trial?
That's pretty good. You know, one of them, lawyers can't resist the urge to hear themselves talk. And, you know, I think overdoing direct examination and keeping a witness on direct up there for 2 or 3 hours and going over the same things. I mean, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. Holding back the cards, maybe on both sides, something that's not produced in discovery and, you know, suddenly comes up at trial and that sort of thing. I think that can hurt either side. You know, but I do think overdoing it sometimes. I like a style that you've got or you've had in the last few trials where you start the examination of an expert with the 3 points you're going to make with them so that that's signposted for the jury and that's in their heads. Then you come back to them. Then even if you don't deal on it too much, it's at least in the minds of the jurors the points you're trying to make. You got to know how to handle the sympathies and empathies of witnesses. I mean, you can go too hard on a witness. I mean, I've done that myself where I felt like I was too tough on an expert. Some jurors are going to sympathize with these doctors who've been sued, who were just, they were in the emergency department. They were just trying to save somebody. And now you're beating up on this poor guy too much. I mean, I think you gotta balance that. But those are some of the things I see.
Well, one of the points you made, I think, really connected with me is don't hold your cards back. Don't try and play the ambush game on either side. And I know, for example, you had a case where a plaintiff's lawyer tried to conceal an important, a critical witness, and said, well, look, we disclosed the witness in our pretrial order. We said we could call any medical person in the medical chart, which could have been 100 healthcare providers. They never identified this person by name, and they get to trial and they want to call them by name. You're like, hey, you know, you can't do that. And that do you remember that? I'm sure you remember that.
I remember that case. Like it was yesterday. It was a Perry Mason moment. They called out next witness, and then they said, call Della Street down here. Yeah. And you people on here may be too young to remember Perry Mason, but Della Street was his secretary. Anyway, we hear this name and I look at my colleague and go, who in the hell's that? They're not on the pretrial order. They're not on the interrogatory answers. And in fact, we had emailed a lot of emails saying, hey, who are your witnesses? I mean, and nobody ever divulged this person. And, you know, the fact is, we would have lost that case. We could have. This was a witness who was going to say that my doctor was lying, that he was not at the bedside when he claimed to be at the bedside. So this is a critical witness in a paralysis case. Could have been one of your $30 million verdicts. Instead, the witness is excluded. The Supreme Court upholds the exclusion of the witness and, frankly, excoriates the conduct of counsel in trying to, who admitted we were trying to win by ambush. I mean, you know, that tactic backfired and the plaintiff lost out because of the strategy used there, because they could have won the case, probably should have.
Yeah. And I don't know where that thinking got embedded in trial work that you should try and ambush people and sneak up on them at trial. It almost always backfires. I mean, it's backfired on a lot of lawyers I know who are trying to hold back an opinion and try to sneak it in without disclosing it, an expert opinion that's supposed to be disclosed. Or they try to hold back some, you know, some other legal theory. And as you know, our approach at my law firm is to fully disclose the case from the very beginning. And we file very detailed complaints. We embed the medical records in the complaints. We make it absolutely clear to the defense where we're coming from. And we don't do that to be nice, but we do it because it's a better way to present your case. It makes you do the work on the front end. It gives fair notice to the defense exactly where we're coming from. So hopefully we can distill the case down to the issues that matter quickly, as opposed to this whole cloak and dagger, hide the gun kind of a approach.
Well, when you started doing that, there are a couple things. Other defense lawyers were saying, can you believe this complaint? It's 800 paragraphs. It's got all the medical records in it. And I said, well, look, first of all, you get to bill for answering all that. So, I get along with the plaintiff's bar because, among other things, we should never complain when we get a case to work on. I mean, or otherwise, it'd be like everybody in Texas who had to quit doing medical malpractice cases when the tort reform eliminated the work. The second thing is, I tell my clients, we know what their case is. I mean, it's not like an allegation that says we violated the standard of care. Now come take depositions and figure out how we violated the standard of care. The medical records are in your complaints. In fact, the other day, one of my doctors, I was going to go meet with him. He didn't have some records. I said, well, hell, just pull the complaint up. It's got all the medical records embedded in it. And I'll bring what you don't have. We'll bring a set of those records for you. So I will add, Lloyd, when you asked me the three things, another thing, I think when plaintiff's lawyers or defense lawyers take medical records out of context, when they when they cherry pick five sentences and don't read the next two or the next paragraph, and then the other side can come back and show that either intentionally or unintentionally, there's an attempt sort of to mislead the jury. The jury loses trust in the lawyer who's up there talking, and it can backfire. So proper use of medical records and using them in context, I think, is also important.
I think you touched on a hugely important point, which is, you know, the credibility of counsel. And it doesn't just, in my view, it doesn't just start in trial. It starts, you know, from the very beginning of a case. I mean, are you presenting a case that's been properly vetted by experts, that's been properly researched, where the attorneys have put in the heavy lifting to clearly lay out what the claims are? Because, you know, I'm very pro doctor. My father was a doctor. My uncle was a doctor. I'm very pro medical profession, but I'm pro good medicine. And I'm very unforgiving personally if I feel like people don't do right by their patients. But the credibility is so important on both sides. You know, the defense tries to hide something, I'm going to point it out a few times. And I've seen you do the same in court. So that's a really important point. Now, I need to be balanced here, Paul. I asked you three mistakes you see plaintiff's lawyers make. I want you to share with me what the three biggest mistakes are that you consistently see other defense lawyers, not your firm, but co-counsel, because you're almost always in trials with other defense lawyers. What are the three biggest mistakes you see your colleagues make? Won't ask you to name names, but just generally speaking.
Well, one of those would be, again, it kind of goes with that lawyers loving to hear themselves talk. I mean, when there's an expert primarily against my defendant, and I feel like I've got that expert where I want him on cross-examination, and then a co-defendant who doesn't really have a dog in the fight with that expert gets up and starts asking a bunch of questions, and they take 30 minutes of time, and they kind of muddle what I thought was in a really good position, and the jury forgets maybe the zinger I thought I had left the jury with this expert. And they sit down, and I'm like, why in the hell did you just screw up my expert there? I think you get lost in things that don't matter to the jury too much. I mean, an hour examination of an economist, you know, who's simply multiplying average work life expectancy by wage or earnings, you know, and reducing it to present value, to question them for an hour on exchange rates and all kind of other things, I think taxes the jury. Honestly, I have a little shtick with experts, and it doesn't take long, and it is what it is, and I've never won or lost a case because of the handling of an expert witness. But otherwise, it's what we were saying before, Lloyd. It's changing your theory at trial, or not coming clean with document production or medical records. I'll tell you this firm here, when people start at my firm, I tell them we overproduce, not underproduce. So if there's a document that needs to be produced in discovery, we're going to produce it. And let everybody deal with the consequences of it.
That's been my experience dealing with your firm, Paul, is that, you know, y'all will turn over the things you're supposed to, text messages between medical providers, you know, relevant to the care or to the patient, for whatever reason. Maybe this is just a coincidence, but it seems that your firm is maybe the only or one of the only firms in town where the professionals ever text each other during the time in question, because we don't see text messages coming out of other firms on a consistent basis. I'll just leave it.
Maybe those defense lawyers are smart enough to tell their doctors to quit texting, but I will tell you, and many of your colleagues know that when we ask, do you have any texts? And then I get this text that says we should have done that test yesterday after the patient has died. It's a gotcha moment. And you wonder how in the world are we going to deal with this? But it is what it is. You rack your brain for every possible privilege that might exist. But if there's not one, you produce the document and deal with it.
Right. You can't. I mean, I did defense work a lifetime ago, both criminal defense work when I was in the Army. And then I did med-mal defense work briefly with Blassingame Birch out of Athens for about 2 years. and got a taste of it. And I remember Gary Blasingame, who was Mr. Blasingame to me at the time, being very clear that, you know, you don't pick your facts. Your job as the advocate is to do the best job you can with your facts and let the chips fall where they may. But don't get funny trying to hide stuff or be cute with evidence, because it'll come back and bite you, hurt you worse than ever. I want to take a moment to acknowledge that this episode of Face the Jury is brought to you by our friends at Hughesby Reporting, the nationwide leader in court reporting, videography, and trial services. I have been working with Hughesby for a number of years, and the things that I like best about them are they are incredibly reliable, they have high-quality court reporters, and their post-production is just excellent. They get the transcripts to us on time. They're very diligent with the exhibits and making sure they're properly organized. And when you're taking a deposition, in as many depositions as we take at Bell Law Firm, that reliability is critical. And we are very pleased to have them as our sponsors. And I would encourage any trial lawyers out there or defense lawyers who want that reliability and that level of service to contact our friends at Hughesby and visit them at Hughesby.com. That's Hughesby.com. Are there times when you get a new client, new file, gets delivered to you, you get the medical records, you review the records, and you conclude, yeah, my client really screwed up. He was negligent or she was negligent, and their negligence caused some really bad harm, just like the plaintiff says. Does that ever happen to you? And if it does, how do you deal with it?
It happens often enough. We get cases that have been vetted by your side where, you know, you've had an expert look at it and your expert's right. I mean, either we missed a test, we missed a lab, we misread a x-ray, and with or without hindsight bias, it's a glaring, obvious miss. Failed to call somebody back to the office, you know. So when that happens, I mean, I do think, and y'all may not believe it on your side, but most carriers these days don't want to waste money on defense costs if they're going to be told 2 years later, you know, we can't defend this case. They want to know it now. And I know y'all don't get many pre-suit resolutions. Sometimes that happens. I know it doesn't happen very often. But I do believe you're going to see some carriers who are doing a better job of assessing cases up front. Can we win this? Do we have a chance? What are our, you know, is there a causation defense? Is there a damage mitigation? And let's get this to early resolution. More and more, Lloyd, I do think that carriers are viewing cases that way. In the main, we have great relationships with our insurance clients, but they're mindful of legal costs and fees. And if they're going to have to pay $100,000 to ultimately settle a case, they're going to look under every rock. And, mm-hmm. If the damages aren't linked to the standard care violation, then they're going to try to exploit causation. If the damages are not as great as the plaintiffs is making them out to be, then they're going to try to go that way. But, you know, there are cases you have to settle. And, you know, we're encouraged, frankly, on this side to tell upper management at most of these carriers if we have a really bad case that needs settling. Because, you know, you told me of a large jury verdict on Friday. I mean, the verdicts are, you know, when the plaintiff gets a verdict these days, in a Med-Mal case, it certainly seems like it's in the 7 and 8 figure range. And so, it only makes sense if you can't make the case better that people look at the possibility of early resolution.
So for the plaintiff's lawyers that may be listening to this podcast who do medical malpractice work, I mean, what advice would you give to people to get the attention early of the decision makers? If it is the kind of case we're talking about, clear liability, compelling facts, clear causation, devoid of the hindsight bias you touched on, mean, what gets the attention of the early attention, I should say. I know that the main thing that gets attention from my point of view is a trial date. That's when people tend to start talking, when there's a trial that's coming up on the calendar. But short of that, what gets the attention of the adjusters?
I do think a well-written pre-suit, you know, demand letter that lays out the facts and tells them who your expert is and why it is that the case seems a slam dunk for the plaintiff. I do think that can have some sway, and cases do occasionally get resolved pre-suit, either by institutions here in Atlanta, hospitals, other groups that you all deal with. But you hit the nail on the head. Time-limited demand letters and trial dates, those are the two things that defense lawyers are told by their carriers, let us know the instant you get those things, because they know that the bad faith, those two words, you know, that causes them heartburn. And the fact that, you know, the case is about to be decided by 12 strangers pretty soon, if that's what we want, you know, that's coming up. So trial dates and, you know, well-written, time-limited demand letters, that's what gets their attention, Lloyd.
Gotcha. Let me shift gears a little bit, Paul. You have more children than Rehoboam. And you have two who are already defense lawyers. You got a daughter in college. You've got a kid at Princeton who's tearing it up on the lacrosse field. I've got a hypothetical question for you. You know, plaintiff's lawyers love hypothetical questions. What would you do? What would you say if one of your kids approached you and said, "Dad, I'm thinking about becoming a plaintiff's lawyer and representing patients instead of doctors"? And after you've poured yourself a glass of scotch and you've steadied your feet, what would you say to your son or daughter who asked that question?
I would say, "Son or daughter, please take my call when I need a loan from you and from going to that side and all the money you're going to make. I want my kids to do whatever is the most rewarding from a work standpoint, from a quality of life standpoint, from a financial standpoint, and I've encouraged them to look at plaintiff's PI work. I mean, they might not go the Med-Mal route just because, you know, I've been doing this for 35 years and I'm ingrained. I'm too old to change horses, and you know, I've got a lot of good doctors on speed dial if you need to, if you injure your arm playing pickleball. But you know, they might not go Med-Mal, but listen, it's lawyering's a noble profession, and there are great lawyers on both sides. And there are medical errors, and there are cases where the lines of white and black blur gray, and those are the hard cases in medicine. But there are healthcare professionals who make mistakes. There are doctors who, you know, some doctors are better than others, and so, you know, I'm going to be proud of whatever they do. I don't like scotch, but
you might be more of a bourbon guy. I get that too. I mean, I've got your kids a little bit older than mine, but, I mean, first priority is they're happy. And second priority is they get off the payroll and start supporting themselves. So wherever that leads them,
most of them might not want to be attorneys because they see how hard we work on your side and this side. You know, and I've got plenty of friends on the plaintiff side and plenty of defense lawyers who change over plaintiff. And I think some of them think right away how easy it is on your side. But the successful plaintiff lawyers work their asses off. So it's hard work on both sides. And they see you working on weekends. They see you working till late at night on a closing argument or a PowerPoint, and they know it's a grind. And in this IT world where all these other jobs are available that don't seem quite so taxing, you know, the law, you know, it's hard, you know, being a good lawyer on either side is very hard work. And but I'm glad I got two lawyers in the family. We may get a few more.
I would not be surprised. And to your point about how hard it is, I mean, that's probably true with any profession. If you want to really excel, you got to put the time and energy into it. But of course, in our field, we've got the added layer of of conflict. You know, we are competing against somebody, you know, and there's that stress that goes along with it. Now the competition should be professional, as it always has been with you, and ethical. Not always the case in every situation. So there's definitely a lot of stress in what we do. Let me ask you this, Paul. You've been doing this work for, I think, going on 30 years now on the defense side. And talk to us about the biggest changes that you've seen in the healthcare industry, and specifically the medical malpractice defense industry over that period of time, and how that's impacted your work.
Well, the biggest change I probably heard in a case with you when I heard the worst two words in med mal defense these days, which is audit trail.
I thought you were going to say plaintiff's verdict. I thought that was verdict
no,
for the plaintiff.
Verdict, that's pretty bad too. But
those are the most beautiful words in the English language.
Music to someone's ears. Now,
okay, tell us about audit trail for people who don't know what you're talking about.
Well, the audit trail obviously is the footprint of the electronic medical record. And the electronic medical record, you know, produces this document that can be accessed that shows every time the chart was entered, by whom and for what and for how long. And also there's an audit trail for the PAC system or for the radiology system to show what images were viewed by whom and that sort of thing. And so I would say the electronic medical record, which leads into the audit trail issues, for me, has been the biggest change in medical malpractice. Because when I started practicing, Lloyd, every note in the chart was a handwritten note, and there was nothing better than a long, summarized, handwritten physician's progress note that you could blow up on one of the old boards before we had computers and stick in front of the jury and tell the whole story right there. Now, you get drop-down boxes. Instead of detailing the neurological exam, they simply check off one occurred. You and I both had a case. You had a case against me where the physician used a templated op note and filled it out before the surgery. So
right.
He had the wrong surgery in the note. Very hard to defend that. So the electronic medical record has changed a lot of things. On the one hand, it's good for the check the box thing, because it's generally easy to prove that your doctor saw the patient or that the nurse saw the patient. On the other hand, the detail of the encounter is a lot more sparse than what we used to have. We've done away with the issue generally of not having a note, but the notes we get are oftentimes more helpful to the plaintiff than the defendant. If they check the wrong box, then you got another problem to explain. In the ER, it's, you know, these electronic medicals for emergency medicine providers, and we do a lot of emergency medicine defense. You know, they can also take you down the wrong rabbit hole, because if, you know, when you're picking the template to use in the ER and you choose headache instead of CNS injury or seizure or stroke, then there's, you know, you answer other questions and you omit things. So without a doubt, to me, Lloyd, the advent of the electronic medical record in the last 10 or 15 years has made it, in my mind, more challenging to defend these cases. And there's nothing better for you guys than an audit trail that, for whatever reason, doesn't show evidence that the physician did what he said he did on any given day. That's difficult to overcome, because, as you know, when it's in black and white and in print, that's what the jury really likes.
Well, and there's a mantra that defendant doctors will recite when they get sued years after an event, and they have no memory of the encounter, and their mantra is, you know, it's my habit and custom to do everything correctly. So I don't remember checking this, checking that, doing this, doing that. I know it's not documented, but I'm sure I did it because it's my habit and custom to do it. And that's so the EMR kind of pushes back on that a little bit. But you made a point a moment ago. I think you're referencing one of our cases about the danger of this templated system with EMRs. We had, you and I had a case with another defendant out in Decatur, DeKalb County, Georgia, and they picked a certain template, which was a headache template, but did not pick the stroke template. So all the questions, that are fed by the EMR to the clinician, kind of, you know, you talk about hindsight bias. This is sort of foresight bias. This, the template sort of directs the care by the clinician, and they're thinking, oh, well, the triage nurse picked this template. Maybe it's a, you know, maybe it's a GI or gastro, a stomach type of template. So all the thinking is gastro related, and people don't stop and think, well, hold on, maybe, you know, maybe this really is talking about a stroke situation, but, you know, we don't have that template going. So I think your point's a really good one, that this, that the EMR is debatable on who it helps the most on the plaintiff versus defense side, but the EMR can definitely be a harm to the plaintiff side if the right circumstances develop, or the wrong circumstances develop, I should say.
You know, I think the world has changed a lot. I think that there is greater access to excellent expert witnesses on the plaintiff side than there used to be. When I started doing this in the 90s, you know, there was a neurosurgeon from Florida that almost always appeared as the plaintiff's neurosurgical expert, whether he'd been sanctioned by governing bodies or not. And, you know, it was the usual cast of characters. It was the same old pathologist we all know who's now in jail. It was one or two ER guys. It was, you couldn't, on your side, in fairness, you couldn't get people who would review cases because they didn't want to testify against colleagues. That's changed a lot. You know, I find that the quality of the plaintiff's experts that we face at trial is much, much better than it used to be. And it used to be, you know, one of the easier tricks in closing argument was to distinguish the credentials of your expert from the credentials of the plaintiff's expert. And, you know, you'd be ahead when you sat down from that, and that would resonate. I found now that the plaintiff's bar has better access and does a better job of hiring excellent experts that make it harder for us to impeach them and make the case more of a horse race, for sure.
Well, and I think that just talking to the experts that we work with, our experts see a connection between what they're doing on the plaintiff side in patient care. I mean, they realize that they're all pro doctor, they're all pro healthcare system, but the really top notch experts are intolerant of bad medicine, you know, truly bad medicine. And, you know, you and I have a case going right now with, I think, every other defense lawyer in the state of Georgia, and my friend Laura Shamp. And we've got the person who is, I believe, inarguably the world's leading expert in this certain type of interventional procedure to help people with stroke. And I know, I'm not speaking out of turn, I know that he feels very strongly about the cases he gets involved in on the plaintiff side, that there was bad care and an outcome that was avoidable, and sort of takes that personally. So to your point, I think you're right. I think experts are more willing. I mean, I haven't been doing this quite as long as you, but I know the better experts on both sides can help the case drive towards a good resolution or a fair resolution. I want to ask you a couple more hard questions. I know we're coming up on our conclusion of the show, but I want to ask you, what trial sticks in your mind as one of your happiest moments? I know anytime you win one, it's going to qualify, and you win a lot and win most. But is there a particular trial where you just felt joyous when the jury came back with the result? Or do you feel joyous with every trial?
I can't single one of those out. You know, we love to win. And I whisper in my doctor's ear before the jury comes back, because I will say, I don't care how old you are, how long you've been doing this, that moment when the jury's about to read the verdict, it causes a vasovagal sensation. But I tell them, no matter how this comes out, we're going to handle this professionally. I've been surprised that we got defense verdicts as fast as we did. I've been disappointed a couple of times, but I can't single one out because also, I mean, I'm human too. And when we win, the other side loses. Usually there's a personal tragedy on the other side. So I can't pick one out. I will say, you know, one of the cases I had with you was one of the hardest losses. And I should have known it was not going to be great for me when you had jurors crying in closing argument. But, you know, I single that one out as a, you know, hard fought case and a good win for you. And, you know, I can't, Lloyd, there's not one, you know, not one win that sort of stands out. I will say one of my first cases they trusted me with out in West Georgia, back when you still had to use pay phones and rotary phones, I was on the phone with a claims adjuster at St. Paul back when they did malpractice insurance to tell them the jury had just retired when they told me the jury was back with a verdict. So one of our colleagues recently got a 15-minute verdict, and I said, I got you beat. This was like five. They wanted to go home. So anyway.
That's the biggest nightmare on the plaintiff side is a quick verdict from the jury after a two-week or week-and-a-half medical malpractice trial. It is never good on the plaintiff side if you hear the jury has a verdict, you know, within 30 minutes or 45 minutes. That's an ugly feeling. But you brought up a case that we had together, and is it okay if I talk to you a little bit about that case? Because that was the first.
Let's leave the names out to protect the
innocent. Of course. But we had an interesting case involving complex regional pain syndrome was the diagnosis, which is a chronic or sort of a miserable pain condition that some people can develop. And it was a weird case, the weird mechanism of injury. It was hard to understand. It's hard to explain how he developed this extreme pain condition. And that was our first trial, I think, we had together. And I think he personally kept the verdict down because we got a good result, and I was pleased with it. But I think another defense lawyer involved, I think we could have been a few million dollars higher. But the things that stand out most in my mind about that case working with you, Paul, was that everything was fluid. I mean, you were able to adapt. You know, we were throwing things at you. We were using a lot of technology. We were trying to move the ball quickly, and you block us at every step and try to object along the way. And a different jury, different judge, I think that could have been a different result. But you know, the stars did align for us.
Well, that's thank goodness. Nice of you. I do say, in retrospect, I may have lost that case in voir dire. I mean, the judge let you do the unfettered voir dire for as long as it took, maybe an hour or two without us even piping up. You picked a great jury. I mean, you got to, you know, looking back on it, hardships weren't much hardships, and those jurors got excused, and I'm sitting over there going, man, Lloyd's got a bunch of bleeding hearts on this jury. I'm in trouble. And when you had them crying in closing argument, you know, that was Katie bar the door. And when the judge let them examine the jurors come out of the jury box to feel your client's arm.
Examine? Is that really the right word?
It might have been. I was a little surprised by that. But you were very savvy to come up with that notion. It turned out well for you.
Well, just for our listeners, context, there's a real debate what my guy's condition was and whether he had this pain condition. And one of the signs that might suggest he had it was a temperature difference in one hand versus the other hand. And I had my expert touch my client's hands in trial. And he said, yeah, I guess one hand's colder than the other. That's consistent with his pain condition. And then you brought in this Hollywood expert out of Rhode Island who is 6'4", looked like he just skied in off the mountain from the U.S. Olympic trials, and Hollywood guy. I mean, he'd make Robert Redford ashamed of his looks. And so I took a chance. I think, you know, after giving it a little bit of thought, I took a chance and said, well, I think I'll have this guy touch my guy's hands and see if he'll acknowledge there's a temperature difference. So we had him touch my client's hands, and he touched them, and predictably, the defense expert's like, you know, I can't tell if there's a temperature difference. So that's when I turned to the judge and said, well, judge, I think the jury should be allowed to examine the evidence themselves, the hands. They could tell temperature difference. They do it with their children anytime they have a fever. You see if they have kid's a little bit hot on the forehead. And I don't think I caused an aneurysm, Paul, but I don't think you were very accepting of my efforts. And you objected a few times, and then a few more. And we had a rigorous debate with the judge. And the judge finally said, you know, I'm going to let the jury do it. And I was all happy with myself because I had won this big debate. And then I turned to the jury and nobody wanted to touch my client's hands at first. And I was like, look, I was pleading with my eyes. I was like, look, we just won this motion. And then finally, this one juror, I can still picture him, said, well, I'd like to touch his hands. And then my client walked over. He's a tough kid from, you know, up north, working class kind of guy. He puts his hands out and the first juror touches his hands. Then the second juror, then the third juror, and almost the entire panel touch my guy's hands with like this gentleness. And that's where I think we won the case. I think the jury put him over the edge after that.
Yeah, he had his arm leaning up against a cooler full of ice water right before that guy filled his arm.
But not true. Not true.
No, that was a huge moment in that case. And, you know, vigorously contested, and it is what it is.
Well, and when it was over, you came over and shook my client's hand. You shook my hand. You congratulated my client. You were you and your whole team were the absolute professionals. And I know that was nobody likes to lose a verdict. And that was a good result from our point of view. And I appreciated that. And I think that has kind of informed our relationship since. You know, you never make it easy. I'll say that. You throw elbows. I'll say that too. But you're the consummate professional, and I appreciate the opportunity to work with you.
Well, thank you, Lloyd.
You bet, Paul. And I appreciate you being on the show today. And thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know you're the busiest defense lawyer in the state. And if you didn't have this trial that had gotten continued, you wouldn't be available to us. So I'm grateful you made time for us, and look forward to seeing you in the courtroom soon.
No, thank you for inviting me, and I hope those plaintiff's lawyers who are mad at me about realize that I am able to shave, but it's all good.
I'm glad to hear it. Well, you take care.
Thank you, Lloyd. We'll see you soon.
Thank you, Paul.